From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
Fratelli cardinali,
I'd like to also thank my brother cardinals
me
who chose
per essere
me to
successore di Pietro,
be the successor of Peter
insieme a voi,
and to
come chiesa
walk
unita,
along with
cercando
you,
sempre la pace, la giustizia,
searching all together for peace
sempre
and justice,
lavorare come uomini
and working
e donne
together,
fedeli a Gesù Cristo,
men and women faithful
senza
to Christ,
paura,
without fear,
per proclamare il Vangelo,
to proclaim
per
the gospel,
missionari,
to be missionaries.
That was Pope Leo XIV, elected just hours ago, history's first American pope. Welcome to this May 8th edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Thanks for tuning in. Well, a historic papacy begins. What does Pope Leo XIV's election mean for the global church and for religious liberty? What is it? How will it apply to debates here at home? Princeton legal scholar Professor Robert George joins us. Even as Catholics celebrate new leadership, anti-Israel protests are flaring once again on university campuses and on Capitol Hill.
It is abundantly clear that the cynical work of the majority party on this committee is now being expanded and weaponized by the administration seeking to squash dissent.
That was Congresswoman Ilhan Omar at yesterday's House Education Committee hearing regarding anti-Semitic behavior on college campuses. And this occurred just moments before mass demonstrators overtook Columbia University's library. Committee Chairman Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan will tell us what Congress is doing about the rising tide of anti-Semitism in higher education. Nearly two dozen self-styled moderate House Republicans now threaten to sink the One Big Beautiful Bill if it scales back Biden-era Medicaid expansion or defunds Planned Parenthood.
When I talk to the reporters that, you know, run around where we are, they're saying that Democrats can't believe, Democrat leadership, Democrat staff, Democrat members can't believe how much Republicans are diving in hard to defend Obamacare and to defend the worst parts of Obamacare, which was the Medicaid expansion and what you described, which is the 90% federal match rate to go to the able-bodied, a population that should be working, the able-bodied instead of the vulnerable for whom Medicaid was created.
That was Texas Congressman Chip Roy sounding the alarm on Fox Business. We'll break down the numbers and the stakes with Paul Winfrey, former director of budget policy at the White House and CEO of the Economic Policy Innovation Center. By the way, I'm going to give you this number, so go ahead and jot it down because you're going to need it. Capitol switchboard number where you can reach your member of Congress, 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. You know, our republic was made not for spectators, but participants, and I'm going to need your participation today. And later, we'll be joined by the Washington Stand's Suzanne Bowdy and FRC's Kana Gonzalez for a closer look at what Congress did and didn't do this week. But before we dive in, a quick reminder, Session 12 of our God and Government course, Making an Effective Appeal to Authority, is now live. You can watch it exclusively on the Stand Firm app or text the word course to 67742. If you don't have the Stand Firm app, that's course to 67742. All of that and more straight ahead on this edition of Washington Watch. Well, before we look at the recurring anti-Semitic environment on college campuses, I want to talk trade for just a moment. This morning, President Donald Trump announced a historic trade deal between the United States and the United Kingdom. This deal, according to the White House, grants American companies unprecedented access to the UK markets while bolstering U.S. national security. In addition, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative says that this sets the tone for other trading partners to achieve reciprocal trade. So how does this deal achieve such lofty expectations? Here to discuss this and more, Congressman Tim Walberg, Chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee and a member of the House Committee on Natural Resources. He represents the 5th Congressional District of Michigan. Congressman Walberg, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always good to see you.
Tony, it's always good to see you as well. And thanks for giving me a chance to step back into common sense.
Well, let's talk trade first, because you come from a state of Michigan where trade's pretty important. What does this deal mean?
Well, I think it's a start, and I think it's an evidence that what the president has been saying all along, that this is a tool that will work for restoring America and setting in place an understanding with our allies around the world who, in many cases, we've been helping them out for many, many years since the world wars. It's time for them to step up the plate and understand that it's not a free pass anymore. So you have to treat us at least fairly on the trade end. So what we've seen today with this trade deal that has been consummated with the UK says a number of good things, I think, for our auto industry. Gives us further involvement, opportunity to export our cars to Europe, to the UK especially. It also helps my farmers, the farmers in my district that are concerned but have been strong and willing to take a deep breath and hope that would work out. Now we get some significant trade opportunities in the UK, $5 billion, what I understand, opportunity for new exports from the US to the UK. Farmers, ranchers, producers that we have, including what I've seen, $700 million in ethanol exports. I guess I'd rather see ethanol in many cases going there, and $250 million in other agricultural products like beef grown in my district. So those are good things. Those are a start, and I think it gives an indication to other countries as well as to our own citizens that these trade deals will take a bit of time, but when they come to fruition, they'll serve us well.
So as you alluded to, and the White House stated, this would be a blueprint. I guess this mints a blueprint because it's one of the early negotiated deals for other trading partners. So what's the timeline here? When will this be implemented with the UK?
Well, as I understand, it's working out. I haven't seen an absolute date on it, but the fact that it's been announced indicates that it's coming quick. And we know how the president works. He wants to work faster as opposed to slower. And so I think that coming out and doing this press announcement indicates that it's not going to be long. And with the other deals that are in the pipeline, just last week sitting behind Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, in the Rose Garden for the National Day of Prayer. He at that day was, at least it was said by the president, that Scott was on the phone with 30 other countries that very day. And I think that indicates things are ramping up. And if the UK goes this direction, I think there are other countries that are going to want to do similar things.
And the president has alluded to a major announcement next week during his Middle East tour. And those close to the White House, sources in the White House, suggest that that has something to do with the economy as well. I want to move on to another issue before we run out of time here, Congressman Wahlberg, and that's something that's really at the heart of the committee work that you're doing right now. In fact, a committee hearing you had yesterday hitting this issue of anti-Semitism that continues on college campuses. Ironically, as you were holding a hearing yesterday, we saw on the campus of Columbia University masked individuals protesting against Israel, the Jewish people, taking over the library there.
Yeah, and desecrating the library it is. I received a video from one of our Columbia student friends, a senior there, that was in the library at that very time. Took videos of what was going on, the defacing of library property, the takeover for over 4 hours from the freedom to use that library by all students. And then ultimately, thankfully, the New York Police Department came in and gave a bum's rush to these people who are abusing their rights as citizens, or I guess we'll wait to see how many of them were on visa, as with student visas, to study here. If we find people that were in that conflagration, as it were, who are legal immigrants under a visa but have abused their opportunity here by demonstrating in such a way support of terrorist organization like Hamas, I'm hoping to see that they'll be removed from the country and they'll have to take their education someplace else because America's free. But the opportunity isn't for people who will abuse the freedom that they have here. So We're going to continue pushing back, and had three college presidents in front of us yesterday from across the nation, trying to show that it's not just at the Eastern liberal Ivy League schools or places like Northwestern and others. It goes to smaller colleges like Haverford in Pennsylvania. We looked at DePaul, which was a surprise that the largest Catholic school in the country was involved with this anti-Semitism on the campus. And then Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, also was in front of us. I think two of the presidents showed that, at the very least, by having this hearing, they've jumped up and are attempting to do some things that I think will bring about some control. But Haverford gave us no indication that she understood at all what potential there is for her and her school to have significant problems by being unwilling to make it very clear that this type of activity goes beyond simple First Amendment liberties. When you start to take away people's free living out of those liberties on the campus, and you put people in fear simply because who they are, what they are, their nationality, their race, their position as a Jew that they can't change, that's wrong and that's un-American.
It's disturbing that we're still seeing this type of activity, although not surprised. This ideology has been around for a long time, this anti-Jewish, anti-people of the book. We've seen it. It's rooted in history. But what I would say, Congressman, is a bit encouraging is the response yesterday on Columbia's university's campus, which is a little different than what we saw last year, where they were coddling these brats. They were, instead of coddling these thugs, they were arresting them, which I would say is a result of, in part, of the hearings that you've been having, that you're showing that this is, you're serious. You're not going to put up with this stuff.
We are serious. We believe in free expression. We believe in the First Amendment liberties in this country. But they cannot be abused. And in talking with the ACLU attorney there yesterday, he certainly didn't get it. We were not decrying speech, even some very unsavory and mean and awful speech. That happens. But when it is used to incite riots, when it's used to incite people to go after other individuals, in this case Jews, and take away their freedom for an education that is enjoyable, meaningful, and is without fear, and when it incites people to follow these same students to their residences, promoting further fear, and when it causes them to beat up students to the point that they have to have surgery for broken wrists, one student that was there yesterday, and others who had concussions as a result, that goes way beyond free speech. We have to stand against that, and it's un-American to boot. And I think that's what's come from the indoctrination that's gone on with liberal faculty, progressive, socialist faculty on campus that do not like America. In fact, they hate America, and they want to change it.
Well, and the good news, under the current administration, it's not going to be funded with taxpayer dollars. Congressman, always great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us, Tim.
Good to be with you, Tony. Have a great day.
You too. Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan, chairman of the Education Committee in the House. All right, when we come back, Professor Robert George of Princeton University joins us to talk about the new pope. So don't go away.
Family Research Council is committed to advancing faith, family, and freedom from the East Coast to the West. So FRC is going to Southern California for this year's Pray, Vote, Stand Summit, October 17th and 18th at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills. Join us for this powerful gathering of Christians desiring cultural renewal and spiritual revival. The Pray, Vote, Stand Summit brings together Christian leaders, issue experts, and government officials for a time of prayer, inspiration, and action. Together, we will seek God's guidance for our nation and engage in meaningful discussions on the intersection of faith, government, and culture. If the spiritual foundations and the cultural walls of our nation are to be rebuilt, we all have a role to play. May we each find our place on the wall as we build for biblical truth. Register now at prayvotestand.org. That's prayvotestand.org.
Download the new Stand Firm app for Apple and Android phones today and join a wonderful community of fellow believers. We've created a special place for you to access news from a biblical perspective, read and listen to daily devotionals, pray for current events, and more. Share the Stand Firm app with your friends, family, and church members, and stand firm everywhere you go.
Hello, I'm Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. Behind me is one of the most recognizable buildings in all the world, the U.S. Capitol. What does it stand for? Well, most people say government. But you know the Bible talks about four institutions of government? You know what they are? And do we have a republic or a democracy? Well, what do you say? Also, what about this thing, separation of church and state? Does that mean Christians shouldn't be involved in government? Guess what? We address those issues and more in our new God and Government course. I invite you to join us to see what the historical record and the Bible has to say about government. Join us for God and Government.
Looking for a trusted source of news that shares your Christian values? Turn to the Washington Stand, your ultimate destination for informed, faith-centered reporting. Our dedicated team goes beyond the headlines, delivering stories that matter most to believers. From breaking events to cultural insights, we provide clear, compassionate coverage through a biblical lens. Discover news you can trust at the Washington Stand, where faith and facts meet every day.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. All right. White smoke billowed from the chimney over the Sistine Chapel early this afternoon, signaling the papal conclave made its decision on electing a new pope. The announcement soon followed that Cardinal Robert Prevost was elected by the conclave, making this a historic day with the announcement of the first ever American pope. What might we expect from this new pope, who has chosen the name Leo XIV? Well, here to discuss this is Professor Robert George, McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and the director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University. He also served as chairman of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. Professor George, welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to see you.
It's great to see you, Tony. Thanks for inviting me back onto the show.
Well, let's talk first. I want to get your reaction to the newly announced pope, and what do we know about him?
Well, my reaction initially was shock. I did not believe that I would, in my lifetime, see an American elected pope. I did not think that an American would be elected pope in my children's lifetime. But here we are. There's an American pope. Now, as it happens, he's a dual national. He's also a national of Peru, where he has spent a third of his life in service to the church as a bishop in Peru. And in fact, he has dual citizenship. But he was born here in the United States. He speaks perfect English. He is an American. So that was astonishing. I don't know him personally, Tony. I've not met him. I don't know a lot about him. He does not have a very vivid public profile. He's worked in important offices in the Vatican Curia, that is the administrative office of the Catholic Church in the Vatican. He's had a very significant role in the appointment of bishops for the Catholic Church throughout the world. He was educated here in the United States at Villanova University. He's relatively young by papal standards, not as young as John Paul II was when he was elected at 58. But at 69, of course, he's younger than Pope Benedict, and he's younger than Pope Francis, and younger than most modern popes. So there you are. Now, his choice of name I found very interesting. This was the second most striking thing. A distant second, because the most striking thing by far was his being an American. The second most striking thing was his choice of name. He chose the name Leo. He will be Leo the 14th. And clearly he's symbolically, Tony, linking himself to the pontificate of Leo XIII, who is widely known in Catholic circles as the first modern pope. Leo XIII served in the final third of the 19th century and the beginning, very beginning, the first couple of years of the 20th century as pope. He, of course, had to manage the church through the upheavals of the Industrial Revolution, and especially the rise of new, profound ideologies, Marxism, nationalism, including nationalism of the sort that only a few decades later would turn into vicious fascism and Nazism. He found a way to bring the gospel to bear on social questions rather than treating the gospel simply as something that applied to our individual spiritual lives and the life of the community of the of believers. He forcefully condemned Marxism and indeed all forms of socialism, but he also rejected laissez-faire, social Darwinist, dog-eat-dog capitalism. So he was not a collectivist by any means, but he wasn't any kind of radical libertarian or individualist. He again found a way that he felt was more in conformity with the gospel, and he inaugurated the great tradition that we come to know as the tradition of Catholic social teaching, which began with his encyclical entitled Rerum Novarum, of New Things, in 1891. Well, that's what I know, Tony.
Well, it sounds like you know quite a bit, Robbie, when it comes to his selection of names. But I want to talk about his place in history, what it could be, given where we are. I mean, internationally, it's I think of Pope John Paul. When we were faced with communism, he worked with Margaret Thatcher, he worked with Ronald Reagan, very clearly to take down the wall in Eastern Europe. We have we have something similar, but it's in Islam, and that I think poses a threat internationally, especially when we look at religious freedom. But we're compromised even here at home in the United States when we look about policies pertaining to the sanctity of human life and marriage. It's a much different world culturally than it was when Pope John Paul stepped into that position.
Yes, there are great challenges that are facing all of us today, certainly facing the Christian community, certainly facing the Catholic Church. Some of those, Tony, are internal in the Catholic Church. I don't think I'm breaking any news, certainly not breaking any news to Catholics, that the administrative structure of the church is badly in need of reform. I think it doesn't go too far to say that there's chaos. Both in terms of the governance of the church internally and its finances. And those governance issues are certainly not unrelated to the terrible scandals, especially the sex scandals that did so much harm to the church and the broader Christian community when they really came to light in the early 2000s. So we need a pope who will be a genuine reformer, someone who knows who's who, what's what, where the bodies are buried, who can bring administrative order to the church, who can root out corruption. There is corruption. I think we have to be very clear and candid about that. There's every reason to believe it, no reason to doubt it. So we need a reformer in that respect. Number two, we face the great challenges of secular progressivism as an ideology that challenges right. gospel teachings. This is true for evangelical Christians. It's true for Eastern Orthodox Christians. It's true for the Catholic Christians. And here we need clarity from Christian leaders. And that's right. what Pope is. He's a Christian leader. So we need clarity. There's an old saying. It's become something of a cliche, but that doesn't mean it's any less true, Tony. And that saying is, clarity is charity. Telling people they're not doing anything wrong or leaving people to think they're not doing anything wrong when in fact they're doing something very bad and destructive of themselves, their families, their relationships, that's not charity. That's not kindness. You're not being kind to people when you let people go on doing things as if there's nothing wrong with them and they're actually destroying people's families and destroying people's lives. We need clarity. And in recent years, I think it's fair to say, there has been some ambiguity, at least perceived ambiguity in Catholic teaching. So we need a pope who will teach with clarity. And then the final thing, Tony, if I can just very quickly wrap up on the third thing. We also, I think, need on the international sphere to get the church's relationships with nation states in order. And this is especially important when it comes to China. Yeah. The Vatican made what can only be called a very bad deal with the Chinese communist regime. Yeah, and that's got to be fixed. Catholics in China are suffering. So are other Christians. So are other believers. And something's got to be done.
We'll continue this conversation later. Folks, stick with us. We're back after this.
At Family Research Council, we believe religious freedom is a fundamental human right that all governments must protect. That's why FRC President Tony Perkins went to Capitol Hill to testify on behalf of persecuted Christians in Nigeria. Islamist terror groups target Christians and other religious minorities in Nigeria with brutal violence. Representative Chris Smith, who chaired the hearing, said 55,000 people have been killed and 21,000 abducted in the last 5 years alone. The congressman also stressed that 89% of Christians in the world who are martyred are from Nigeria.
Yet the government of Nigeria has failed to make progress against religiously motivated persecution of Christians, despite religious freedom being enshrined as an essential human right in their constitution.
Tony Perkins called for the United States to send an unmistakable message.
This is systematic religious violence. Nigeria must be redesignated a country of particular concern. Biden administration's removal of this designation was a reckless mistake that emboldened the very terrorists who are slaughtering Christians.
Redesignating Nigeria will enable the U.S. government to pressure Nigerian leaders to protect vulnerable Christians.
These are not just numbers. These are fathers, their mothers, their children, their families.
Bishop Wilfred Anagabe risked his life to speak out, sharing firsthand accounts of the danger faced in his church district in central Nigeria.
We live in fear because at any point it can be our turn to be killed, but to remain silent is to die twice. So, I have chosen to speak.
FRC is calling on President Trump to act now to promote religious freedom around the globe and speak up on behalf of Christians in Nigeria.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us. And to what Professor George was saying, I would just say, amen. We need the spiritual leaders to speak with moral clarity to our political leaders. They shouldn't be taking their cues from the political leaders. And we need that here in this country when it comes to important issues, defining issues like the sanctity of life, marriage, human sexuality, all of those issues. All right. Let's move along. As congressional negotiations continue over President Trump's one big beautiful bill, the budget plan, as that continues, two issues in particular appear to be in the thick of it. One is Medicaid. There was the expansion of Medicaid, which has cost a lot and is going to cost a lot more, and could sink Medicaid for those individuals who truly need it. The other thing that has appeared this week, in fact, just yesterday, was that in the reconciliation has been the call to defund Planned Parenthood. That last count was about $700 million that it received from the federal government. Well, now we have moderates in the GOP, not Democrats, but moderate Republicans saying, I don't think we can support dialing back Medicaid. We've got to keep it like it is. Well, let's talk about that. And here to discuss this, Dr. Paul Winfrey, the founder, president, and CEO of the Economic Policy Innovation Center. Paul is also the former White House Director of Budget Policy, having served during the first Trump administration. Paul, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, I want you to break this down for us because, you know, we hear Medicaid, the Republicans are going to cut Medicaid, the sky's falling. What they're trying to do, as I understand it, is dial back some of the expansion of the Biden administration that actually threatens the program because they can't be funded.
That's right. First of all, nobody's talking about actually cutting the program. We're just talking about slightly slowing the growth over the next 10 years, which is necessary, as you said, to protect the vulnerable population, right? So one of the things that's happened in the last 15 years with Obamacare coming online in 2014 after being passed in 2010 is that states, for every one state dollar that they spend, they get $9 from the federal government for the able-bodied childless adult population that was in the Obamacare expansion, and they get $1.33 for the vulnerable population, so for pregnant moms and kids and the disabled. And one of the things that we've seen happen just over the last really 5 years is that all of the incentives within the healthcare system, in part because of some rules that the Biden administration promulgated, have been redirecting healthcare towards the expansion population, the able-bodied childless adults. And that's leaving the vulnerable truly unprotected.
And if I recall correctly, Paul, that during the Biden administration, it was primarily the blue states that expanded it and accepted more of this, where many of the Republicans said, no, we're not going to get hung up in this scheme because we've seen this movie before. I remember back when I was in the state legislature in Louisiana, the federal government entices you into these programs, and then at some point they cut off the federal funding and you're left with the bill. But a 9-to-1 ratio is a pretty strong incentive for the states to expand.
That's right. And one of the things that the 10 states that haven't expanded are hearing from their hospitals and their insurers is that they're leaving all this federal money on the table and then they have to expand. But the reality is that if we keep pushing towards a larger and larger growth in government control and in government funding for healthcare, eventually it's gonna set us up for single payer, which is exactly what the Democrats knew they were going to be doing when they passed Obamacare right. in the first place. They knew that we would ultimately get here. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that one of the things that the Republicans would consider as they move through this reconciliation, this budget bill, is adjusting for some of the inequities in the program so that we make sure that we can protect it for the truly vulnerable and that it's there for them when they need it.
So specifically, what should they do? Because we see some in those blue states saying, we don't want to touch it, don't want to dial it back. But then if the other states that haven't taken it, if they were to expand theirs as well, how are we going to pay for that?
So there are three things that they should be doing. The first thing that they should be doing is reducing the federal match for the able-bodied population down to the vulnerable level, right? So that the medical system, it stops prioritizing the able-bodied versus the truly vulnerable. The second thing that they need to do, and this is something that the Trump administration can actually help with, is that during the Biden administration, they promulgated rules that said that Medicaid can pay up to commercial rates. Well, commercial rates are often 2 or 3 times higher than Medicare rates, which means that the healthcare system now is incentivized again to treat the able-bodied population over even the Medicare population. So just saying that Medicaid can't pay more than Medicare would be a helpful thing. And it's actually a big budgetary saver. It would save about $70 billion a year if the Trump administration were to promulgate a rule that does that and Congress were to codify it. And then the third thing that they should do is reduce this game, this scam that the states play, where they tax Medicaid providers and then they get the federal government to cover a big share of that tax, and then they pocket that money and they use it for things that have absolutely nothing to do with healthcare, like, you know, putting sprinkler systems into the, you know, the in front of the mansion, the California governor's mansion, and things right. like this. There are lots of, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse that they can go after.
You know, Dr. Winfrey, that makes so much sense. And the structure of the system is fundamentally flawed. It has to be fixed. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us. Very insightful. Folks, stick with us. We're coming back with more Washington Watch as we wrap up, so don't go away.
Are you ready to transform your trials into triumphs? Dive into the Book of Daniel with FRC's new study guide, Daniel, Visions and Valor. Perfect for those seeking courage and wisdom from one of the Bible's most faithful figures. This 13-day journey is ideal for small groups or individual study as part of our ongoing Stand on the Word Bible reading plan. It's a timeless resource ready to deepen your engagement with Scripture. Explore how Daniel's life and God-given visions offer a blueprint for navigating challenges. Each day includes scriptures, reflection questions, and space for notes to enhance your understanding and application. Available in digital and physical formats, order your copy of Daniel, Visions and Valor today and start your journey of transformation. To order, text the word Daniel to 67742. That's Daniel to 67742.
What is God's role in government? What does the separation of church and state really mean? And how does morality shape a nation? President John Adams said our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Join Family Research Council for God and Government, a powerful 13-part series that equips you with biblical truth to engage in today's most pressing debates. From the Ten Commandments in classrooms to the immigration crisis of America, we'll uncover the foundations of our nation's history and why it's relevant for today. Defend God's plan for government, because faith and freedom were never meant to be separate. New episodes available each Monday. To view the series on the Stand Firm app, text COURSE to 67742.
How should Christians think about the thorny issues shaping our culture? How should Christians address deceitful ideas like transgenderism, critical theory, or assisted suicide? How can Christians navigate raising children in a broken culture, the war on gender roles, or rebuilding our once great nation? Outstanding is a podcast from the Washington Stand dedicated to these critical conversations. Outstanding seeks to tear down what our corrupt culture lifts up with an aim to take every thought and every idea captive to the obedience of Christ. Whether policies or partisan politics, whether conflict in America or conflict abroad, join us and our guests as we examine the headlines through the lens of Scripture and explore how Christians can faithfully exalt Christ in all of life. Follow Outstanding on your favorite podcast app and look for new episodes each week.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us. I didn't get into this with Dr. Winfrey, but the other issue that has come up this week is the defunding of Planned Parenthood, which is in the reconciliation bill. We've got a handful of moderates that are saying, "Oh, we can't do that. We can't do that. We can't defund Planned Parenthood." Really? I mean, that's something that has been the focal point for Republicans for decades. Why would we give $700 million to Planned Parenthood? That's the tax dollars they got in their last report. So this is where you got to take action. You need to contact your member of Congress and tell them, no, we are not funding Planned Parenthood. The Republicans control the White House. And they have workable control of, and I understand that the margins are very, very thin, but in reconciliation, this is the only opportunity to get it through the Senate. The Republicans should stand together on this. This is a fundamental issue. We shouldn't be funding organizations that not only fund abortion, but also Planned Parenthood as the abortion pill, which is another topic for this administration. But as Planned Parenthood sees they're losing money, in part because the abortion pill is now about 70% of abortions, depending on whose numbers you look at. So they're moving into providing transgender treatments, experimental drugs, in some cases for minors, and circumventing their parents, and even in states where it's illegal. So why should we fund that? So text the word Congress to 67742. That's Congress to 67742, and I'll send you a link so that you can contact your member of Congress. That's Congress to 67742. Our word for today comes from Daniel chapter 9. In the first year of Darius, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the numbers of years that must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. The year was 538 B.C., shortly before Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. From studying the prophet Jeremiah, Daniel realized that Israel's captivity was nearing its end. The 70 years were almost complete. He may have also been reading Isaiah, whose words echoed God's promise of restoration. These prophetic writings didn't lead Daniel to passive waiting. They propelled him into prayer. He called upon God to fulfill what he had promised. This may explain why spiritual opposition intensified, eventually manifesting in the political scheme that landed Daniel in the lion's den. What looked like palace intrigue was really a spiritual battle, forces of darkness attempting to block God's purposes. When we pray for the fulfillment of God's word, we join Jesus when he said, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." That kind of prayer disrupts hell's agenda, and that's precisely why it matters. For more on our journey through the Bible, text Bible to 67742. Well, Congress has departed town this afternoon, and we'll return next Tuesday. So what got accomplished this week and what did not? Joining me now to discuss this, Suzanne Bowdy, editorial director and senior writer at the Washington Stand. Suzanne, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tony.
So a lot happened this week, and in the background of it, all Congress was focused, a lot of it was focused on the budget reconciliation. But there seems to be a few roadblocks along the way. Let's talk about that.
Well, poor Mike Johnson, I don't think he's had a week yet where he hasn't had some sort of major obstacle to overcome. And you have to give him credit. He's really handled his job miraculously, as some would put it. He's dealing with, as we all know, a very slim majority, just three votes he can lose on any piece of legislation at this point. But within the Republican Party, unfortunately for him, are some very clear dividing lines between the moderates in the party from blue states, swing states who are vulnerable in the next election, and also the hardline conservatives, which I would assume Johnson himself, if he were still just a congressman, would find himself aligned with. So he's walking a tightrope here, trying to please both sides in order to come up with a one big, beautiful bill that will actually make it over the finish line into the Senate. This week has presented a lot of obstacles. You were just talking in the last segment about Medicaid reform. Unfortunately for Mike Johnson, the two sides of his caucus have very different ideas about what those reform should look like. I think that you outlined some of those with a doctor there. But for him, he's up against a wall right now trying to please both sides. It's not an enviable position to be in. But as you've talked to Mike Johnson extensively, you know that he's been able to do some amazing things. And I hope for his sake that he's able to do that and meet the deadline that's imposed on him, which is sometime between Memorial Day and July 4th.
So let's talk a little more specifics when it comes to the Medicaid. I know we were talking about this with Paul, but I think it's very important that people understand what we're discussing. I'm going to play clip number 13 of Congressman Mike Lawler.
I've been very clear in this, and that I will not support any proposal that cuts benefits or reduces services for Medicare or Medicaid. These programs are lifelines for millions of Americans, and we must strengthen them, not chip away at them.
All right, he's one of the moderates who are saying they will not support a reconciliation bill if there are any reductions to Medicaid. Now, let me be very clear. There are no reductions being proposed for Medicare, which is for the elderly. The Medicaid, it's simply, as we're being discussed, was the expansion and the disproportionate 9-to-1 federal funding for able-bodied individuals, men who don't have children, who could go to work. I mean, this sounds like common sense. Why would we be doing this?
It is common sense. And Chip Roy, one of the conservatives that's been leading the effort to really reform Medicaid, had said, hey, we're not cutting any sort of care for these populations. What we're doing is making sure that we're serving the correct populations. As you brought up, this has been expanded. I mean, right now, I think about 90 million Americans are currently on Medicaid, which is a shocking number when you consider the cost that accrues to taxpayers. All that these conservatives are asking for is that A, you get rid of the fraud, waste, and abuse that DOGE has identified. B, you make sure that if you are able-bodied and you can work, that you work to get those benefits. Three, that no illegals be a part of Medicaid, which, as we've seen from some of the DOGE work, there are illegal immigrants profiting from this, and that the care of the actual vulnerable does not come after the care of these people that should not be on the program in the first place.
So to address those issues, you are dialing back Medicaid. You're not affecting people who should legitimately get it, but you are reducing. And so what these moderates are saying, we don't want to touch it. We want status quo. We want to continue the Ponzi scheme that the Democrats put in place that will ultimately break the system and be there for no one. That's what they're saying. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I hear them say.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's very disappointing to hear that, along with these moderates, as you mentioned, saying that they won't defund Planned Parenthood, which is the easiest lift of all. We're talking about something that 57% of the American people oppose, which is their tax dollars going to an organization whose primary goal is killing innocent young children. So at some point, Mike Johnson has to say, well, if you can't cut Medicaid and you won't defund Planned Parenthood, where are these cuts going to come from? And the answer is Medicaid is the biggest chunk, the biggest pool that they can go after to find these savings. They're looking for a floor now of $2 trillion. We saw that 32 House Republicans sent a letter to the House Speaker saying, we will not accept less than $2 trillion. That's about $500 billion more than they said earlier. So we're not even looking for $1.5 trillion. We're looking for $2 trillion. And to do that without Medicaid, which makes up about $900 billion of our spending, where do you find those cuts? At some point, the moderates have to give, and it's time for the conservatives to say, look, we've compromised enough. It's time for you to compromise.
All right. You're going to get me all worked up here when we start talking about Planned Parenthood. This organization is built on a lie. It conducts itself fraudulently, and it's doing so with taxpayer dollars. Now, and this is a free country; you can do whatever you want. I mean, within the confines of the law. But I would say they even break the law. I mean, they've been caught trafficking in human baby body parts. They have been caught on film helping minors get abortions without their parents knowing about it, facilitating human trafficking. And now they're doing the same thing when it comes to so-called gender-affirming experimental drugs, circumventing the rights of parents. Okay, so they're doing this. It's illegal, and they're under investigation in certain states. Why should the federal government be writing them a check upwards of $700 million?
There's absolutely no reason, and it's something that I believe both sides should be able to come to an agreement on, regardless of whether you think abortion should be legal or not. The American taxpayer should not be forced to fund it, many of whom oppose abortion at all stages, let alone most Americans, even on the liberal side, who say after the first trimester, we don't want anything to do with abortion in this country. And then to have them subsidize it, which right now is up to almost 9 months and some, in some states, or even after birth, as we've seen with some of the infanticide laws, it's unconscionable. And now with a White House, with a Congress that are led by Republicans, this should be an easy lift. It should be the first thing they do and the first savings they find.
Now, these moderates, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania and Mike Lawler of New York, that we heard a clip from him. This was a closed-door meeting that took place yesterday where they were saying, hey, we didn't even know about this, and we're not going to support it. Well, it's been in reconciliation from the very start. Now, to be very clear, these funds are covered by the Hyde, so they don't directly fund abortion, but we know that money is fungible, and so it takes care of the overhead so they can spend their money either, ironically, on political activity, as they have been doing in their engagement in elections, or they can use it to cover the overhead in the abortion clinics. So you know, the bottom line is they're getting federal money. They're getting taxpayer dollars to do this. So, folks, I want to encourage you. This is where we draw the line. If we don't do it now, when do we do it? I mean, when will Planned Parenthood be defunded? When will we put aside organizations like SPLC? If the Republicans don't do it now, when will it happen? So text the word Congress to 67742. That's Congress to 67742, and I'll send you a link so that you can contact your member of Congress and say, defund Planned Parenthood. This is time to draw the line and say, no more. We're not doing this. All right. So, Suzanne, on to other issues as Congress has left town for the week. They come back on Tuesday. What other business did they accomplish or was left undone?
Well, I will say reconciliation has taken up a good chunk of the Republicans' time this last week, actually for the last month or so. I know that the Trump budget was also released. Some very interesting things in the Trump budget, which is usually just a guideline for how the party and the White House is hoping that Republicans will deal with spending in the upcoming months as they're working on appropriations. You do still have several House committees that are going line by line, trying to find the savings that they need in appropriations to do this reconciliation bill. So I believe some of the more contentious markups will be next week in the House Energy and Commerce Committee, for one, where all these Medicaid reforms will have to come to the forefront. They'll have to find some consensus there as they go into the markups, and then they'll vote in committee and then bring it out to the floor. But that in itself should be pretty interesting. They will have to find some sort of agreement before they go into the markups, or this will drag out even longer.
So are we going to see a puff of white smoke above the Capitol by the end of next week?
I'm sure Mike Johnson would like for that to happen.
They have set a deadline in part because of the debt ceiling cliff, because the debt ceiling will probably be hit in June. So they were hoping to get this through the House onto the president's desk by Memorial Day. That's not going to happen. They might be able to get it through the House, but they're going to have to come to terms with where they find, as you said, initially it was 1.5. There are conservatives saying it needs to be $2 trillion. I don't see how they're going to get to that place. I think $1.5 trillion is probably going to be the best that they can do. But even that is going to be a stretch if they can't get their moderate colleagues to go along with some of these reforms.
Well, and unfortunately, one of the ideas that you saw floated today by Trump himself, if they can't come to some agreement on Medicaid, was, well, we're going to have to bring taxing the rich back on the table, because how do you pay for all of this? How do you continue to pay for people who don't belong on Medicaid and all of the other government bloat that we're not dealing with? Nobody said this would be easy. Nobody said that paring back all of this spending from years and years of programs that have ballooned out of control would be easy. But it has to be done. Otherwise, you're not going to have the extension of the Trump tax cuts. And if you don't, as Mike Johnson has said, every family will get a $2,000 to $3,000 tax hike. So they're going to have to find some way to pay for it. That's either by saying, hey, we can't do the Trump tax cuts, we can't make them permanent, we can only extend them for a few years if we can't find the money to pay for it, or we're going to have to raise taxes elsewhere. And I don't think the Republican Party would really enjoy the campaign ads of raising taxes as a way to pay for some of President Trump's biggest agenda items.
Yeah, it didn't work out so well back in 1992 for George H.W. Bush when taxes were raised. And look, you talk about debt. $36 trillion. Go look at the debt clock. That is moving faster than Al Sharpton moves toward a camera, and it is just rapidly going up. We're almost at $37 trillion. If we don't address it now, when do we address it? Suzanne Bowdy, thanks so much for joining us and giving us a wrap up for the week.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, folks, and your action item, text the word Congress to 67742. That's Congress to 67742, and I'll send you a link so that you can reach your member of Congress and tell them to defund Planned Parenthood, and you can tell them to do the Medicaid reforms that are necessary to advance this reconciliation and start addressing our national debt. All right, we're out of time for today. Thanks for joining us. Until next time. I leave you with the words of the Apostle Paul. When you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, you've prepared and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.